Two locked doors with a 5-foot space between them, where you had to stand while the nurse relocked the first door and unlocked the second. Just inside, 3 phone booths. Then a couple of single rooms and the living room and eat-in kitchen. This arrangement ensured a good first impression for visitors. Once you turned the corner past the living room, though, things changed. A long, long hallway. Too long. 7 or 8 double rooms on one side, the nursing station centered on the other, flanked by the conference room and hydrotherapy tub room. Lunatics to the left, staff to the right. The toilets and shower rooms were also to the right, as though the staff claimed oversight of our most private acts. A blackboard with our 20-odd names in green chalk and spaces after each where we, in white chalk, entered our destination, departure time, and time of return whenever we left the ward. The blackboard hung directly across from the nursing station. When someone was restricted to the ward, the head nurse wrote, "Restricted," in green chalk beside the name. We got advance warning of an admission when a new name appeared on the list, sometimes as much as a day before the person of that name appeared on the hall. The discharged and the dead stayed on the list for a while in silent memoriam. At the end of the terrible hall, the terrible TV room. We liked it. At least we preferred it to the living room. It was messy, noisy, smoky, and most important, it was on the left, lunatic side of things. As far as we were concerned, the living room belonged to the staff. We often agitated to move our weekly hall meeting from the living room to the TV room. It never happened. After the TV room, another turn in the hall. 2 more singles, 1 double, a toilet, and seclusion. The seclusion room was the size of the average suburban bathroom. Its only window was the chicken wire-enforced one in the door that allowed people to look in and see what you were up to. You couldn't get up to much in there. The only thing in it was a bare mattress on the green linoleum floor. The walls were chipped, as though somebody had been at them with fingernails or teeth. The seclusion room was supposed to be soundproof. It wasn't. You could pop into the seclusion room, shut the door, and yell for a while. When you were done, you could open the door and leave. Yelling in the TV room or the hall was acting out and was not a good idea. But yelling in the seclusion room was fine. You could also request to be locked into the seclusion room. Not many people made that request. You had to request to get out, too. A nurse would look through the chicken wire and decide if you were ready to come out, somewhat like looking at a cake through the glass of the oven door. The seclusion room etiquette was, if you weren't locked in, anybody could join you. A nurse could interrupt your yelling to try to find out why you were yelling, or some other crazy person could come in and start yelling too. Hence the request business. Freedom was the price of privacy. The real purpose of the seclusion room, though, was to quarantine people who'd gone bananas. As a group, we maintained a certain level of noisiness and misery. Anyone who sustained a higher level for more than a few hours was put in seclusion. Otherwise, the staff reasoned, we would all turn up the volume on our nuttiness, and the staff would lose control. There were no objective criteria for deciding to put someone into seclusion. It was relative, like the grading curve in high school. Seclusion worked. After a day or a night in there with nothing to do, most people calmed down. If they didn't, they went to maximum security. Our double-locked doors, our steel-mesh window screens, our kitchen stocked with plastic knives and locked unless a nurse was with us, our bathroom doors that didn't lock, all this was medium security. Maximum security was another world. The hospital was on a hill outside of town, the way hospitals are in movies about the insane. Our hospital was famous and had housed many great poets and singers. Did the hospital specialize in poets and singers, or was it that poets and singers specialized in madness? Ray Charles was the most famous ex-patient. We all hoped he'd return and serenade us from the window of the drug rehabilitation ward. He never did. We had the Taylor family, though. James graduated to a different hospital before I arrived, but Kate and Livingston were there. In Ray Charles's absence, their North Carolina twanged blues made us sad enough. When you're sad, you need to hear your sorrow structured into sound. Robert Lowell also didn't come while I was there. Sylvia Plath had come and gone. What is it about meter and cadence and rhythm that makes their makers mad? The grounds were large and beautifully planted. They were pristine as well, since we were almost never allowed to walk around. But now and then, for a special treat, we were taken through them on the way to get ice cream. The group had an atomic structure, a nucleus of nuts surrounded by darting, nervous nurse electrons charged with our protection, or with protecting the residents of Belmont from us. The residents were well-heeled. Most worked as engineers or technocrats along the technology highway, Route 128. The important other type of Belmont resident was the John Bircher. The John Birch Society lay as far to the east of Belmont as the hospital lay to the west. We saw the two institutions as variations on each other. Doubtless the Birchers did not see it this way. But between us, we had Belmont surrounded. The engineers knew this, and they took care not to stare when we came into the ice cream parlor. Saying that we traveled with a group of nurses does not explain the situation. A complex system of privileges determined how many nurses accompanied each patient and whether a patient could leave the grounds in the first place. The privileges started at no privileges, restricted to the ward. This was often Lisa's condition. Sometimes she was bumped up to the next rung, 2-to-1s. That meant she could leave the ward if she had two nurses with her, though only to go to the cafeteria or occupational therapy. Even with our high staff-to-patient ratio, 2-to-1s often meant restricted to the ward. Two nurses could rarely be spared to take Lisa by the elbows and hustle her over to dinner. Then there were 1-to-1s, a nurse and patient bound together like Siamese twins. Some patients were on 1-to-1s even on the ward, which was like having a page or valet, or like having a bad conscience. It depended on the nurse. A lousy nurse on 1-to-1s could be a problem. It was usually a long-term assignment, so the nurse could get to understand her patient. The gradations were Byzantine. 1-to-2s, one nurse, two patients, led to group, 3 or 4 patients and one nurse. If you behaved in group, you got something called destination privileges. This meant telephoning the head nurse the moment you arrived at wherever you were going to let her know you were there. You had to call before coming back, too, so she could calculate time and distance in case you ran away instead. Then there was mutual escort, which was two relatively not crazy patients going places together, and the top, grounds, which meant you could go all over the hospital alone. Once these stations of the cross were achieved within the hospital, the whole circuit began again in the outside world. Someone who had mutual escort or grounds would probably still be on group outside. So when we went to Bailey's in Waverly Square with our retinue of nurses, the arrangement of atoms in our molecule was more complex than it appeared to the engineers' wives sipping coffee at the counter and graciously pretending not to look at us. Lisa wouldn't have been with us. Lisa never made it past 1-to-1s after her third escape. Polly was on 1-to-1s, but that was to make her feel safe, not hemmed in, and she always came along. My roommate Georgina and I were on group, but since nobody else was on group, we were effectively on 1-to-2s. Cynthia and the Martian's girlfriend were on 1-to-2s. This made it seem that Georgina and I were as crazy as Cynthia and the Martian's girlfriend. We weren't, and there was a bit of resentment on our part. Daisy, who later committed suicide, was at the top of the chart. Full towns and grounds. Nobody could understand why. 6 patients, 3 nurses. It was a 10 or 15 minute walk down the hill, past the rose bushes and stately trees of our beautiful hospital. The farther we got from our ward, the jumpier the nurses became. By the time we hit the street, they were silent and closed in on us, and they had assumed the nonchalant look, an expression that said, "I am not a nurse escorting 6 lunatics to the ice cream parlor." But they were, and we were their 6 lunatics, so we behaved like lunatics. None of us did anything unusual. We just kept up doing whatever we did back on the ward, muttering, snarling, crying. Daisy poked people. Georgina complained about not being as crazy as those other two. "Stop acting out," a nurse would say. They were not above pinching us or giving a daisy-like poke to try shutting us up. Nurse nips. We didn't blame them for trying, and they didn't blame us for being ourselves. It was all we had, the truth, and the nurses knew it. The floor of the ice cream parlor bothered me. It was black and white checkerboard tile, bigger than supermarket checkerboard. If I looked only at a white square, I would be all right. But it was hard to ignore the black squares that surrounded the white ones. The contrast got under my skin. I always felt itchy in the ice cream parlor. The floor meant yes, no, this, that, up, down, day, night, all the indecisions and opposites that were bad enough in life without having them spelled out for you on the floor. A new boy was dishing out cones. We approached him in a phalanx. "We want 8 ice cream cones," said one of the nurses. "Okay," he said. He had a friendly, pimply face. It took a long time to decide what flavors we wanted. It always did. "Peppermint stick," said the Martian's girlfriend. "It's just called peppermint," said Georgina. "Peppermint dick." "Honestly." Georgina was revving up for a complaint. "Peppermint clit." The Martian's girlfriend got a nurse nip for that. There were no other takers for peppermint. Chocolate was a big favorite. For spring, they had a new flavor, peach melba. I ordered that. "You gonna want nuts on these?" the new boy asked. We looked at one another. Should we say it? The nurses held their breath. Outside, the birds were singing. "I don't think we need them," said Georgina. 5-minute checks, 15-minute checks, half-hour checks. Some nurses said, "checks," when they opened the door. Click, turn the knob, swish, open the door. Checks, swish, pull the door shut, click, turn the knob. 5-minute checks. Not enough time to drink a cup of coffee, read 3 pages of a book, take a shower. When digital watches were invented years later, they reminded me of 5-minute checks. They murdered time in the same way, slowly, chopping off pieces of it and lobbing them into the dustbin with a little click to let you know time was gone. Click, swish, checks, swish, click. Another 5 minutes of life down the drain, and spent in this place. I got on to half-hour checks eventually, but Georgina remained on 15-minute checks, so as long as we were in the same room, it made no difference. Click, swish, checks, swish, click. It was one reason we preferred sitting in front of the nursing station. The person on checks could pop her head out and take her survey without bothering us. Sometimes they had the audacity to ask where someone was. Click, swish, checks. The rhythm broke for a moment. "Have you seen Polly?" "I'm not doing your job for you," Georgina growled. Swish, click. Before you knew it, she'd be back. Click, swish, checks, swish, click. It never stopped, even at night. It was our lullaby. It was our metronome, our pulse. It was our lives, measured out in doses slightly larger than those famous coffee spoons. Soup spoons, maybe? Dented tin spoons, brimming with what should have been sweet but was sour, gone off, gone by without our savoring it. Our lives. That doctor says he interviewed me for 3 hours. I say it was 20 minutes. 20 minutes between my walking in the door and his deciding to send me to McLean. I might have spent another hour in his office while he called the hospital, called my parents, called the taxi. An hour and a half is the most I'll grant him. We can't both be right. Does it matter which of us is right? It matters to me, but it turns out I'm wrong. I have a piece of hard evidence, the "time admitted" line from the nurse's report of patient on admission. From that I can reconstruct everything. It reads 1:30 p.m. I said I left home early, but my idea of early might have been as late as 9 in the morning. I'd switched night and day. That was one of the things the doctor harped on. I said I was in his office before 8, but I seem to have been wrong about that, too. I'll compromise by saying that I left home at 8 and spent an hour traveling to a 9 o'clock appointment. 20 minutes later is 9:20. Now let's jump ahead to the taxi ride. The trip from Newton to Belmont takes about half an hour, and I remember waiting 15 minutes in the administration building to sign myself in. Add another 15 minutes of bureaucracy before I reach the nurse who wrote that report. This totals up to an hour, which means I arrived at the hospital at 12:30. And there we are, between 9:20 and 12:30, a 3-hour interview. I still think I'm right. I'm right about what counts. But now you believe him. Don't be so quick. I have more evidence. The admission note, written by the doctor who supervised my case and who evidently took an extensive history before I reached that nurse. At the top right corner, at the line, hour of admission, it reads 11:30 a.m. Let's reconstruct it again. Subtracting the half hour waiting to be admitted and wading through bureaucracy takes us to 11 o'clock. Subtracting the half hour taxi ride takes us to 10:30. Subtracting the hour I waited while the doctor made phone calls takes us to 9:30. Assuming my departure from home at 8 o'clock for a 9 o'clock appointment results in a half-hour interview. There we are, between 9 and 9:30. I won't quibble over 10 minutes. Now you believe me. Insanity comes in two basic varieties, slow and fast. I'm not talking about onset or duration. I mean the quality of the insanity, the day-to-day business of being nuts. There are a lot of names: depression, catatonia, mania, anxiety, agitation. They don't tell you much. The predominant quality of the slow form is viscosity. Experience is thick. Perceptions are thickened and dulled. Time is slow, dripping slowly through the clogged filter of thickened perception. The body temperature is low. The pulse is sluggish. The immune system is half asleep. The organism is torpid and brackish. Even the reflexes are diminished, as if the lower leg couldn't be bothered to jerk itself out of its stupor when the knee is tapped. Viscosity occurs on a cellular level, and so does velocity. In contrast to viscosity's cellular coma, velocity endows every platelet and muscle fiber with a mind of its own, a means of knowing and commenting on its own behavior. There is too much perception, and beyond the plethora of perceptions, a plethora of thoughts about the perceptions and about the fact of having perceptions. Digestion could kill you. What I mean is the unceasing awareness of the processes of digestion could exhaust you to death. And digestion is just an involuntary sideline to thinking, which is where the real trouble begins. Take a thought, anything, it doesn't matter. I'm tired of sitting here in front of the nursing station, a perfectly reasonable thought. Here's what velocity does to it. First, break down the sentence. I'm tired. Well, are you really tired exactly? Is that like sleepy? You have to check all your body parts for sleepiness. And while you're doing that, there's a bombardment of images of sleepiness along these lines. Head falling onto pillow, head hitting pillow, winkin', blinkin', and nod. Little Nemo rubbing sleep from his eyes. A sea monster. Uh-oh, a sea monster. If you're lucky, you can avoid the sea monster and stick with sleepiness. Back to the pillow. Memories of having mumps at age 5. Sensation of swollen cheeks on pillows and pain on salivation. Stop. Go back to sleepiness. But the salivation notion is too alluring, and now there's an excursion into the mouth. You've been here before, and it's bad. It's the tongue. Once you think of the tongue, it becomes an intrusion. Why is the tongue so large? Why is it scratchy on the sides? Is that a vitamin deficiency? Could you remove the tongue? Wouldn't your mouth be less bothersome without it? There'd be more room in there. The tongue now, every cell of the tongue, is enormous. It's a vast foreign object in your mouth. Trying to diminish the size of your tongue, you focus your attention on its components. Tip, smooth. Back, bumpy. Sides, scratchy, as noted earlier, vitamin deficiency. Roots, trouble. There are roots to the tongue. You've seen them, and if you put your finger in your mouth, you can feel them, but you can't feel them with the tongue. It's a paradox. Paradox. The tortoise and the hare. Achilles and the what? The tortoise? The tendon? The tongue? Back to tongue. While you weren't thinking of it, it got a little smaller. But thinking of it makes it big again. Why is it scratchy on the sides? Is that a vitamin deficiency? You've thought these thoughts already, but now these thoughts have been stuck onto your tongue. They adhere to the existence of your tongue. All of that took less than a minute, and there's still the rest of the sentence to figure out. And all you wanted, really, was to decide whether or not to stand up. Viscosity and velocity are opposites, yet they can look the same. Viscosity causes the stillness of disinclination. Velocity causes the stillness of fascination. An observer can't tell if a person is silent and still because inner life has stalled or because inner life is transfixingly busy. Something common to both is repetitive thought. Experiences seem pre-recorded, stylized. Particular patterns of thought get attached to particular movements or activities, and before you know it, it's impossible to approach that movement or activity without dislodging an avalanche of pre-thought thoughts. A lethargic avalanche of synthetic thought can take days to fall. Part of the mute paralysis of viscosity comes from knowing every detail of what's ahead and having to wait for its arrival. Here comes the I'm no good thought. That takes care of today. All day, the insistent dripping of I'm no good. The next thought, the next day, is I'm the angel of death. This thought has a glittering expanse of panic behind it, which is unreachable. Viscosity flattens the effervescence of panic. These thoughts have no meaning. They are idiot mantras that exist in a prearranged cycle. I'm no good. I'm the angel of death. I'm stupid. I can't do anything. Thinking the first thought triggers the whole circuit. It's like the flu. First a sore throat, then, inevitably, a stuffy nose and a cough. Once, these thoughts must have had a meaning. They must have meant what they said. But repetition has blunted them. They have become background music, a muzak medley of self-hatred themes. Which is worse, overload or underload? Luckily, I never had to choose. One or the other would assert itself, rush or dribble through me, and pass on. Pass on to where? Back into my cells to lurk like a virus waiting for the next opportunity? Out into the ether of the world to wait for the circumstances that would provoke its reappearance? Endogenous or exogenous, nature or nurture, it's the great mystery of mental illness. I need some fresh air, said Lisa. We were sitting on the floor in front of the nursing station, as usual. Daisy passed by. Give me a cigarette, she said. Get your own, bitch, said Lisa. Then she gave her one. Lousy cigarette, said Daisy. Lisa smoked Cools. I need some fresh air, Lisa repeated. She stubbed her cigarette out on the brown and beige speckled rug and stood up. Hey! She put her head into the nursing station, in through the open half of the Dutch door. I need some fucking fresh air. Just a minute, Lisa, said a voice from inside. Now! Lisa banged on the sill that divided the top and bottom halves of the door. This is illegal. You can't keep a person inside a building for months. I'm going to call my lawyer. Lisa often threatened to call her lawyer. She had a court-appointed lawyer, about 26, handsome, with almond eyes. He hadn't been able to stop her being committed. His name was Irwin. Lisa claimed to have fucked him a few times in the lawyer-client conference room at the courthouse. Whenever Lisa threatened to call her lawyer, the head nurse got involved. Now she came out and leaned on the sill. What's up, Lisa? She said, sounding tired. I want some fucking fresh air. You don't have to yell, said the head nurse. How the fuck else am I going to get any attention in this place? Lisa always called the hospital this place. I'm right in front of you now, the head nurse said. I'm paying attention. Then you know what I want. I'll get an aide to open your window, said the head nurse. Window, said Lisa. She turned briefly to look at us. I'm not interested in some fucking window. She hit the sill again. The head nurse moved back a bit. "It's window or nothing, Lisa," she said.
"Window or nothing," said Lisa in a sing-song.
She took a few steps down the hall so that all of us, including the head nurse, could see her. "I'd just like to see how you'd manage this place, never going outside, never even breathing fresh air, never being able to open your own fucking window, with a bunch of sissy cunts telling you what to do. Valerie, time for lunch. Valerie, you don't have to yell. Valerie, time for your sleeping meds. Valerie, stop acting out. You know, I mean, how the fuck would you manage, huh?" The head nurse's name was Valerie. "I mean, you wouldn't last 10 minutes in this place."
"Fucking bitch," said Daisy.
"Who asked you?" Lisa pointed at Daisy.
"Give me a cigarette," said Daisy.
"Get your own," said Lisa. She turned to the head nurse. "I'm going to call my lawyer."
"Okay," said the head nurse. She was pretty smart.
"You think I got no rights? Is that what you think?
Should I put the call through?"
Lisa waved her arm dismissively.
"Nah," she said.
"Nah, open the window."
"Judy," said the head nurse. This was a young blonde aide we enjoyed tormenting.
"Valerie," yelled Lisa. She called the head nurse Valerie only when she was upset.
"Valerie, I want you to open my window."
"I'm busy, Lisa."
"I'll call my lawyer."
"Judy can do it."
"I don't want that fucking sissy cunt in my room."
"Oh, you are such a bore," said the head nurse. She pressed the security buzzer that unlocked the bottom of the door and came out into the hall with us. Lisa smiled. To open a window, a staff person had to unlock the security screen, which was a thick, impregnable mesh on a steel frame, then lift the heavy, unbreakable glass-paned window, then shut and relock the security screen. This took about 3 minutes, and it was hard work. It was the sort of thing aides did. When the window was open, air might make its way through the mesh of the security screen, if it was a breezy day. The head nurse returned from Lisa's room a little pink from exertion.
"Okay," she said. She rapped on the nursing station door to be buzzed back in.
Lisa lit another cigarette.
"Your window's open," said the head nurse.
"I'm aware of that," said Lisa.
"You aren't even going in there, are you?"
The head nurse sighed.
"Hey, man," said Lisa. "It passes the time."
She touched the hot end of her cigarette to her arm for a second.
"I mean, that took up 20 minutes, maybe half an hour."
The buzzer sounded. The head nurse opened the door, went inside, and leaned on the sill again.
"Yes, it does pass the time," she said.
"Give me a cigarette," said Daisy.
"Get your own, bitch," said Lisa.
Then she gave her one. Valerie was about 30. She was tall and had tapered legs and arms. She looked a lot like Lisa, though she was fair. They both had lean, long haunches and flexible joints. Lisa was good at curling herself into chairs and corners, and so was Valerie. When someone was upset and had tucked herself between a radiator and a wall, or behind a bathtub, or into another small, secure spot, Valerie could curl herself into a compact package and sit near that person. Valerie's fair hair was beautiful, but she kept it hidden in a braid that she twisted up on the back of her head. This braid in a bun never came undone or slipped out of place. Rarely, Valerie could be coaxed into undoing the bun and showing us the braid, which reached to her waist. Only Lisa could convince her to do this. She never released her hair from the braid, though we begged her to. Valerie was strict and inflexible, and she was the only staff person we trusted. We trusted her because she wasn't afraid of us. She wasn't afraid of doctors, either. She didn't have much to say about anything, and we liked her for that, too. We had to hear a lot of talk in that place. Each of us saw 3 doctors a day, the ward doctor, the resident, and our own therapist. Mostly, we had to hear ourselves talk to these doctors, but they did a fair amount of talking themselves. They had a special language: regression, acting out, hostility, withdrawal, indulging in behavior. This last phrase could be attached to any activity and make it sound suspicious. Indulging in eating behavior, talking behavior, writing behavior. In the outside world, people ate and talked and wrote, but nothing we did was simple. Valerie was a relief from that. The only phrase she used was acting out, and she used it correctly to mean getting in my hair and driving me crazy. She said things like, cut that out, and you're a bore. She said what she meant, just as we did. The doctors were men. The nurses and aides were women. There were two exceptions, Jerry the aide and Dr. Wick. Jerry was willowy and worried. He had one good trick. Now and then, someone with a lot of privileges was allowed to leave the hospital in a taxi. That person would say, Jerry, call me a cab. Jerry would say, you're a cab. We loved this. Dr. Wick was another story. Dr. Wick was the head of our ward, South Belknap 2. The wards had boarding school names like East House and South Belknap, and Dr. Wick would have been a good boarding school matron. She came from Rhodesia, and she looked like the ghost of a horse. When she talked, she sounded somewhat like a horse as well. She had a low, burbly voice, and her colonial English accent gave her sentences a neighing cadence. Dr. Wick seemed utterly innocent about American culture, which made her an odd choice to head an adolescent girl's ward. And she was easily shocked about sexual matters. The word fuck made her pale horse face flush. It flushed a lot when she was around us. A representative conversation with Dr. Wick. Good morning. It has been decided that you were compulsively promiscuous. Would you like to tell me about that? No. This is the best of several bad responses, I've decided. For instance, the attachment to your high school English teacher. Dr. Wick always uses words like attachment. Huh? Would you like to tell me about that? Well, he drove me to New York. That was when I realized he was interested. He brought along a wonderful vegetarian lunch for me. But that wasn't when it was. When what was? When we fucked. Flush. Go on. We went to the Frick. I'd never been there. There was this Vermeer, see? This amazing painting of a girl having a music lesson. I just couldn't believe how amazing it was. So when did you, when was it? Doesn't you want to hear about the Vermeer? That's what I remember. What? The, attachment. How did it start? Oh, later, back home. Suddenly I know what she wants. I was at his house. We had poetry meetings at his house. And everybody had left. So we were just sitting there on the sofa alone. And he said, do you want to fuck? Flush. He used that word? Yup. He didn't. He kissed me. And he'd kissed me in New York, too. But why should I disappoint her? This was called therapy. Luckily, Dr. Wick had a lot of girls to take care of, so therapy with her was brief, maybe 5 minutes a day. But in her wake came the resident. There was a 2 or 3 minute breather between Dr. Wick's departure and the resident's arrival. During this time, we could think of new things to say or formulate complaints. Residents were in charge of privileges, medication, phone calls, the day-to-day matters that were not important enough for Dr. Wick to bother with. Residents changed every 6 months. We'd just begin to figure out how to manage one resident when he'd be snatched out from under us and replaced with a new, incomprehensible resident. They started out tough and ended up exhausted and ready to leave. A few started out with compassion. They ended up bitter because we took advantage of them. A representative conversation with a resident. Good morning. How are your bowel movements? I want to get off group. I want destination privileges. Do you have any headaches? I've been on group for 6 months. The head nurse said you were acting out after lunch yesterday. She's making that up. Hostility. He scribbles in a notebook. Can I have orders for Tylenol instead of aspirin? There's no difference. Aspirin gives me a stomach ache. Are you having headaches? This is in case I do. Hypochondria. He scribbles again. But these two doctors were hors d'oeuvre. The entree was the therapist. Most of us saw our therapists every day. Cynthia didn't. She had therapy twice a week and shock therapy once a week. And Lisa didn't go to therapy. She had a therapist, but he used her hour to take a nap. If she was extremely bored, she'd demand to be taken to his office, where she'd find him snoozing in his chair.
Gotcha, she'd say. Then she'd come back to the ward. The rest of us traipsed off day after day to exhume the past. Therapists had nothing to do with our everyday lives. Don't talk about the hospital, my therapist said, if I complained about Daisy or a stupid nurse. We're not here to talk about the hospital. They couldn't grant or rescind privileges, help us get rid of smelly roommates, stop AIDS from pestering us. The only power they had was the power to dope us up. Thorazine, Stelazine, Melaril, Librium, Valium, the therapist's friends. The resident could put us on that stuff, too, in an acute situation. Once we were on it, it was hard to get off. A bit like heroin, except it was the staff who got addicted to our taking it. You're doing so well, the resident would say. That was because those things knocked the heart out of us. Half a dozen nurses, including Valerie, and an aide or two, were on duty during the day. The night staff consisted of three comfy, big-bosomed Irish women who called us dearie. Occasionally there was a comfy, big-bosomed black woman who called us honey. The night staff would hug us if we needed a hug. The day staff adhered to the no physical contact rule. Between day and night was a dark universe called evening, which began at 3:15, when the day staff retired to the living room to gossip about us with the evening staff. At 3:30, everyone emerged. Power had been transferred. From then until 11, when the comfy women took over, we were in Mrs. McWeeny's hands. Perhaps it was Mrs. McWeeny who made dusk such a dangerous time. No matter the season, dusk began at 3:15 with her arrival. Mrs. McWeeny was dry, tight, small, and pig-eyed. If Dr. Wick was a disguised boarding school matron, Mrs. McWeeny was an undisguised prison matron. She had hard gray hair pressed into waves that grasped her scalp like a migraine. The day nurses, following Valerie's lead, wore unbuttoned nurse coats over street clothes. No such informality for Mrs. McWeeny. She wore a creaky white uniform and spongy ripple-soled nurse shoes that she painted white every week. We could watch the paint cracking and peeling off between Monday and Friday. Mrs. McWeeny and Valerie did not get along. This was fascinating, like overhearing your parents having a fight. Mrs. McWeeny cast on Valerie's clothes and hair the same disapproving eye she gave us, and clicked her teeth with impatience as Valerie gathered her coat and pocketbook and left the nursing station at 3:30. Valerie ignored her. Valerie was able to ignore people in an obvious way. As long as Valerie was on the ward, we felt safe hating Mrs. McWeeny. But as soon as her long tapered back had receded down the hall and out the double-locked double doors, we were overcome by gloom, shot through with anxiety. Now Mrs. McWeeny was in power. Her power wasn't absolute, but it was close. She shared it with a mysterious doctor on call. She never called him. I can handle this, she said. She had more confidence in her ability to handle things than we did. Many evenings were spent arguing about whether the doctor on call should make an appearance. We'll have to agree to disagree, Mrs. McWeeny said about 10 times per evening. She had an endless store of cliches. When Mrs. McWeeny said, we'll just have to agree to disagree, or little pitchers have big ears, or smile and the world smiles with you, cry and you cry alone, a faint but delighted grin came onto her face. Clearly, she was nuts. We were locked up for 8 hours a day with a crazy woman who hated us. Mrs. McWeeny was unpredictable. She'd gnarl her face up for no reason while giving out bedtime meds and slam back into the nursing station without a word. We'd have to wait for her to calm down before getting our nightly Mickey Finns. Sometimes we waited as long as half an hour. Every morning we complained to Valerie about Mrs. McWeeny, although we never said anything about waiting for our meds. We knew Mrs. McWeeny was a crazy person who had to earn a living. We weren't trying to get her decertified. We just wanted her off our ward. Valerie was unsympathetic to our complaints. Mrs. McWeeny is a professional, she said. She's been in this business a lot longer than I have. So what? Said Georgina. She's fucking nuts, Lisa yelled. You don't have to yell, Lisa. I'm right here, said Valerie.
We were all protecting Mrs. McWeeny, one way or another. Mrs. McWeeny wasn't the only person in need of protection. Now and then there was an influx of student nurses. They were migratory, passing through our hospital on their way to operating rooms and cardiac care units. They followed real nurses around in a flock, asking questions and getting underfoot. "Oh, that Tiffany, she sticks to me like a barnacle," the nurses would complain. Then we got the chance to say, "Sucks, doesn't it, being followed around all the time?" The nurses would have to grant us this point. The student nurses were about 19 or 20, our age. They had clean, eager faces and clean, ironed uniforms. Their innocence and incompetence aroused our pity, unlike the incompetence of AIDS, which aroused our scorn. This was partly because student nurses stayed only a few weeks, whereas aides were incompetent for years at a stretch. Mainly, though, it was because when we looked at the student nurses, we saw alternate versions of ourselves. They were living out lives we might have been living if we hadn't been occupied with being mental patients. They shared apartments and had boyfriends and talked about clothes. We wanted to protect them so that they could go on living these lives. They were our proxies. They loved talking to us. We asked them what movies they'd seen and how they'd done on their exams and when they were getting married. Most of them had sadly small engagement rings. They'd tell us anything, that the boyfriend was insisting they do it before the wedding, that the mother was a drinker, that the grades were bad and the scholarship wasn't going to be renewed. We gave them good advice. Use a condom. Call Alcoholics Anonymous. Work hard for the rest of the semester and bring your grades up. Later they'd report back to us, "You were right, thanks a lot." We did our best to control our snarls and mutterings and tears when they were around. Consequently, they learned nothing about psychiatric nursing. When they finished their rotation, all they took with them were improved versions of us, halfway between our miserable selves and the normality we saw embodied in them. For some of us, this was the closest we would ever come to a cure. As soon as they left, things went quickly back to worse than usual, and the real nurses had their hands full. Thus our keepers. As for finders, well, we had to be our own finders.